He had a nasty, smug look on his Aryan poster boy face, but at least he didn't say, "I told you so," to Aldrich. He was smarter than that, anyway. Aldrich, for his part, composed himself, gestured to the driver to roll down his window, and tossed my phone out of the car. By craning my head, I was just able to see my last link to Jesse and the rest of my life explode against the pavement.
"That was a poor choice, Miss Bernard," Aldrich said. "I hope you won't regret it when your friends and colleagues' heads are rolling in the streets this evening."
He made a sad, clucking noise.
"And I tried to help you."
I narrowed my eyes at him. "You tried to subjugate me. It's not the same thing, you dumbass third-rate Bond villain." I shook my head. "Jesus, you idiots have been watching me all this time, and you've learned nothing about me. But I've learned about you. I know you're scared." Aldrich glowered.
"Excuse me? You heard me?"
I mimicked his tone. "You believe I can stop you tonight, and you think Dashiell and the others, our whole way of life, is a threat to your plan. So you kidnap me and try to dress it up as a decision I get to make. I call bullshit, you sanctimonious piece of sister-fucking-Euro-trash garbage. Fuck you and the horse you think you're going to ride on tonight. I will crush you." For 1 second, something like fear flickered in Aldrich's eyes. And then he chuckled.
"Oh, Miss Bernard, I think I'm really going to enjoy the process of breaking you."
His voice was chilling. I opened my mouth to deliver what I'm sure was a scathing rebuttal, but none of us ever got to find out what I was going to say, because at that moment, a certain red Lexus T-boned the Mercedes and knocked us off the road. Chapter 39. Jesse had lucked out with the cops who came to interview him. They were from the Northeast Division of the LAPD, far away from his own former precinct, and if they recognized him from his book, they didn't mention anything. It helped that the story was simple and short. He had arrived to meet his brother, but Noah was already lying there, beaten up. That was it. They told him they'd be investigating the attack, but said in all frankness they didn't have a lot of hope unless witnesses came forward, they found the car, or Noah woke up and identified his attackers. Jesse told them he understood, and they promised to be in touch. The rest of his morning was occupied by a flurry of doctor's updates, nurse's updates, pacing the waiting room, and talking on the phone to his parents. By the time they arrived around noon, Noah was out of surgery and in intensive care. Jesse's mom, Carmen, came rushing into the hospital room first, her makeup running down her face. She was a short, solid woman with glossy dark hair that was graying at the temples. She was wearing a green velvet dress for the wedding, but she'd swapped whatever shoes she'd had on for Keds.
"Mijo!"
she cried out, throwing her arms around Jesse.
"What happened?"
"Hi, Mom."
Jesse bent down to accept the hug.
"Is Dad parking the car?"
"I'm here,"
said Robert Aston, puffing his way into the room. Jesse's parents had made a deal before their sons were born that both boys would take Carmen's last name, and Robert had chosen their first names. He was a few years older than his wife, medium height, with silvering blonde hair and warm blue eyes.
"Your mother's just faster. What did I miss?"
Jesse stepped aside so they could see Noah in the bed. His brother was nearly unrecognizable, his face swollen and bruised, and most of his exposed skin seemed to be hooked up to machines. Jesse had spent a lot of time in hospitals, but he only recognized half of them. Carmen cried out, and the two of them rushed to Noah's side. Jesse gave them the same story he'd told the police.
"Where is the doctor?"
Jesse's mother asked anxiously.
"I have so many questions."
Jesse checked his watch.
"He should be stopping by again in a couple of minutes,"
he said. Carmen turned her full attention to him.
"You look so tired, mijo. Why don't you go get something to eat? We'll be here."
Jesse wasn't really hungry, but he wanted to check his phone and figure out what was happening with Scarlett. And he wouldn't mind some non-hospital air.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be back in a few.
Jesse left Noah's room and headed down the hallway, already pulling out his phone. There was a new voicemail from Scarlett. He was just about to listen when he heard his brother's name and looked up.
No, I'm not technically family,
said the woman who'd spoken. She was Indian, a couple of years older than Jesse, pretty and harried-looking, with a light British accent.
As I said, however, they're expecting me.
Sashi?
Jesse asked. The woman turned, blinked, and said,
Oh my, you must be Jesse.
Yeah.
Over her shoulder, Jesse smiled at the nurse.
This is Noah's girlfriend. She's also a
physician's assistant,
Sashi filled in, showing the nurse some sort of laminated credentials.
In Las Vegas?
Yes, Jesse said. Right.
The nurse looked a little skeptical, but Jesse gave her his best smile.
Would it be okay if we let her in to see Noah?
He led her back down the hall to Noah's room and said under his breath,
Thank you for coming. Scarlett wasn't sure you'd even get her message.
Yes, well, Scarlett sounded very upset on the phone, so I caught the 10 o'clock flight. I tried to call her when I landed, but her mobile went straight to voicemail.
They'd reached the right door, but Sashi stopped short.
Give me a quick rundown of his injuries, she instructed.
I don't remember all the medical terms, but his left ankle is broken, he has a massive concussion, and his brain is swelling. Lots of bruising. They've already done surgery to fix internal bleeding and remove a chunk of his skull to help with the swelling. He's in an induced coma.
She took it all in for a moment, nodding.
Is the ankle a compound fracture?
No, just a simple break.
Right. When I speak to his body, I'll focus on the brain and internal injuries. Those are the most life-threatening. The ankle should heal itself in time, and it will look too suspicious if the bone suddenly knits back together.
Jesse was a little thrown by when I speak to his body, but he just said,
Whatever you need. Whatever you want.
She nodded, checked whether anyone was coming down the hall, and unbelted her trench coat. Underneath, she was wearing a conservative gray dress and a white lab coat. Anyone passing by would just see another doctor in a busy hospital. Jesse was impressed, but then this is what she did.
I need time with him. An hour would be best.
My parents are in there.
Sashi wrinkled her nose.
That will complicate things. Can you get rid of them?
We're going to have to stick to the girlfriend's story.
Fine. What do I need to know?
Jesse told her a few things about Noah, including where he lived and his job.
All right, Sashi said. We've been dating long distance for 6 months, but it's only started to look serious in the last two. I'm a PA, and I want to check his chart myself.
Got it.
He held the door for her.
Let's do this.
Jesse made the introductions. His father took the news in stride, but Carmen was fascinated to learn about Sashi, the girlfriend Noah had never mentioned, and did not, in fact, know about. Jesse had to do some tap dancing, but he eventually convinced his parents to go to the cafeteria with him for lunch, giving Sashi a little time alone with Noah.
But we just got here!
Carmen protested again as Jesse ushered them out.
And I have so many questions.
He scrambled to think of something to say that would temporarily divert her attention from Noah's condition, preferably without lying too much, and finally said,
There's something I want to tell you about anyway. I'm seeing someone too.
That got Carmen to turn her head away. As they walked back down the hall, Jesse had a sense of deja vu and remembered he hadn't actually checked the voicemail from Scarlett.
I'm just going to pop into the restroom, then we'll go get lunch,
he promised his mother. In the single-stall bathroom, he played Scarlett's message.
Hey, it's me,
I know you don't want me going to Sunken City without you, but I'm out of other ideas, so I'm going to run down there. Shadow's with me, and I've got my knives and bulletproof vest. Scarlet paused, probably wondering if she needed to say something relationship-y now. She added in a softer voice, "We're gonna be fine, Jesse." He cursed and called her cell. It went straight to voicemail. Jesse tried again, with the same result. He cursed longer and louder, in Spanish and then English. Sunken City could be dangerous, even if you weren't being pursued by an evil witch clan, and she'd gone down there anyway. Jesse debated with himself for a moment. He knew that Scarlet's relationship had failed partly because Eli had been controlling and overprotective. The werewolf had been so obsessed with Scarlet's safety that he'd ignored what she actually wanted. Jesse didn't want to make the same mistake, especially now that they were finally on the same page about dating. At the same time, she was pregnant, she was being hunted, and she was outnumbered. And, maybe most important, she hadn't actually said she wanted to go by herself, or that she wanted him to give her space. Jesse decided that he would take the risk of Scarlet accusing him of smothering. This was too important. He sighed. Now he just had to figure out what to tell his mother. 20 minutes later, Jesse was practically flying down the 110. He'd given his parents a hasty excuse about Scarlet being in a fender bender. He'd talked about her many times, and ducked out before they could ask questions. He was definitely going to pay for that later, and Sashi might get annoyed if they went straight back to Noah's room, especially if they saw or heard something they shouldn't. But Sashi was a pro. She would figure something out. In his gut, Jesse was sure something was wrong. He tried calling her again, but Scarlet still didn't answer her phone. Next, Jesse called Abby Hain, the woman in charge of all of Dashiell's technological needs. Abby usually worked a pretty pedestrian Monday to Friday schedule, but he hoped that with the Luparii in town, Dashiell or Hain would have put her on high alert. Sure enough, she answered immediately.
"What's up, Jesse?"
"Abby, can you trace Scarlet's newest phone for me?" There was a brief pause, then Abby said dryly,
"There's this thing called Find My iPhone now."
Jesse reminded himself that Abby was employed by Dashiell and didn't actually owe him anything.
I know, but I'm driving, and I don't know if it'll work with the newest phone. Please?"
She heard the urgency in his voice and said,
Okay. I gotta put the phone down while I get to the computer."
Abby had cerebral palsy and usually used a wheelchair at work. A couple of minutes went by, and then she was back.
"Okay, I'm tracing it now. She's in San Pedro, right on the ocean."
Thank God.
Maybe he really was overreacting. Jesse would be happy to take that particular hit, though.
"I'm headed down there now. I may need to have you check again, okay?"
He could practically hear her eyes rolling.
"I live to serve."
40 minutes later, the I-10 was about to dump him onto Gaffrey Street in San Pedro, about 3 miles north of Sunken City. He tried Scarlet first, and this time the phone rang, but she didn't answer. Frowning, Jesse called Abby back.
"Do you still have her location?"
A pause, then,
"She's headed north on Pacific."
"Okay, good."
Pacific ran parallel to Gaffrey, 1 block east.
"Do you..."
Abby began, but Jesse's call waiting beeped. It was Scarlet.
"Thanks, Abby. Call you back,"
he said in a rush and clicked over.
"Oh my God, Scar, where are you? I've been..."
"Jesse, listen..." He shut up. Her voice was all wrong, sad, and resigned. She told him she loved him, and he knew something terrible was happening.
"I'm in a long black Mercedes on the corner of 7th and Pacific," she started to say, and then the phone call was abruptly cut off.
Fear seemed to pulse through all of Jesse's extremities like a jolt of adrenaline.
He was still on Gaffrey, but he took his eyes off the road to check the map on his phone, which was incredibly dangerous and stupid. Then he topped that by cutting across two lanes of traffic to take a screeching left onto First Avenue, speeding a block east to Pacific Avenue. He turned right and leaned forward, craning his neck, looking for a Mercedes. In some parts of Los Angeles, finding a single Mercedes might have been impossible, but this area was San Pedro's answer to a commercial district, Chinese food and liquor stores and laundromats. He didn't see any Mercedes. Jesse was beginning to despair when he had to stop at a light on Pacific. Oncoming traffic had the green with a left turn arrow, and Jesse spotted a weird-looking black car, sort of halfway between a limo and a sedan. It was turning left, trying to get off Pacific Avenue. He saw the Mercedes logo on the grill and, without really thinking it through, pressed his foot on the gas. He wasn't flooring it, and the Mercedes wasn't going very fast, but Jesse's airbag still popped as the Lexus's bumper hit the side of the Mercedes, just in front of the passenger seat. His head snapped back and forth, but he was already unbuckling and tipping himself out of the car when the driver of the Mercedes stepped out with a handgun raised. Disoriented, Jesse pulled his own gun and crouched, duck-walking to the back door of the Mercedes. He tugged it open, and a gunshot instantly whipped past his ear. He half-stood and peeked through the window into the car. The shot had come from a bodyguard-looking man who lay on his back on the floor of the car. Scarlett was in the seat closest to the door, facing backward. There was also an old man laying halfway across the seat, partially tipped off it. Jesse's quick impression was of a turtle trying to right itself.
"Get back!"
Scarlett yelled to him, and she kicked the hands of the bodyguard, sending his gun tumbling away. The man started to rise, but Scarlett stomped down hard, right on his nuts. It looked excruciating. Meanwhile, the driver of the Mercedes had come around the nose of the car, climbing and sliding over the point where it still connected to the Lexus. He had his gun out, but Jesse raised his own weapon before the driver could shoot. He put two bullets in the man's chest, realized he was wearing a vest, and shot him in the head. Scarlett fell out of the still-open car door, kicking it shut behind her. One of the two men must have been reaching for her, because there was a scream of pain. Jesse struggled to his feet. Scarlett's eyes were huge and panicked.
"Run!"
she yelled. Chapter 40. The moment the cars impacted, there was some part of my hindbrain that started doing my job. Camera phones, traffic cameras, witnesses. But like it or not, cleaning up a supernatural mess wasn't currently my problem. The problem was surviving one. When I tumbled out of the back seat of the car, Jesse took my hand and we dashed away into a crowd of onlookers. No one followed us. Aldrich was too old, Roland was too injured, and the driver, as it turned out, was too dead. No one in the crowd was interested in pursuing people with at least one gun. A big part of me wanted to stay and fight, to hold my ground until Aldrich was dead or at least really, really hurt. But for one thing, there were way too many witnesses, and for another, I had to get back to Shadow before the Luparii could. If Aldrich gathered his wits enough to send his guy after Shadow, there was a possibility that she'd let herself be captured again, thinking it might save my life. The car accident was 2.5 miles from Sunken City. At first, as we ran, I was looking for a cab, but traffic was picking up, and it was only going to get worse now that we'd blocked off a huge chunk of Pacific Avenue. Then I figured we could just run the whole way there. I ran 5 miles 3 days a week, so 3 wasn't out of the question. But I got a stitch in my side, and my boots were hurting my feet, and at one point, Jesse looked over his shoulder at me and skidded to a stop.
"Scar? You okay?"
"I'm great," I said, breathing hard. "Let's go get Shadow."
"We need a pit stop."
Jesse glanced around for a moment. There was a 7-Eleven on the west side of the street, and he walked me over there and went straight to a cooler of bottled water.
If you try to give me any fucking crackers, I'm going to feed them to you, and I don't mean through your mouth. I warned him. He flashed that heart-stopping smile at me, but it disappeared right away.
I want you to stay here,
he said, his eyes pleading. We were standing in the back of the store, away from the windows.
The Luparii don't know you're here, and if they did, they wouldn't attack you in the middle of a convenience store with video cameras. I'll get Shadow and Astrid's truck and come back for you.
I nodded. Okay. I pulled out the keys and handed them to him. He looked shocked.
Okay?
Jesse, I'm exhausted, and I feel like crap, and we've got a long night of trying to stop the wild hunt ahead of us. Shadow trusts you. I trust you. So, bring back my dog.
I'm gonna tell her you called her that.
He leaned in and kissed me, hard and fast.
I'll be right back.
Be careful! I yelled after him. I wasn't too worried, though. When I'd expanded my radius back at Sunken City, I hadn't felt any witches besides Aldrich. Whoever he'd left behind was human, and Jesse could handle himself against a human. While I waited, I went to the counter with an armful of snacks and a new disposable cell phone, since mine had gone out the Mercedes window. As the clerk rang me up, I said bluntly, "Listen, my boyfriend went to change our tire a couple of blocks away. Would you have somewhere I could sit down? I'm 6 weeks pregnant and I feel like crap." The clerk, a Middle Eastern woman in a hijab, glanced up from the register and really looked at me for the first time, taking in the scratches on my face and arms and my general air of exhaustion. Then she smiled and came out from around the counter with a folding chair and told me to help myself to a magazine. It took more than an hour, but finally Jesse returned, looking as tired as I felt. He entered the store alone, and I jumped up from my chair.
Is she...
His face broke into a smile.
We don't have her little assistant's cape, remember? She's in the parking lot.
I practically ran for the door, yelling a thank you in the general direction of the clerk. Shadow was waiting just on the other side of the glass, her breath creating a foggy spot. She backed up so I could come out, then reared up on her hind legs, rested her front paws on my shoulders, and began licking my cheek. She let out a soft, happy bark. I laughed and pushed her gently away.
"I've never heard her do that," Jesse said, sounding amazed. "That's because the Luparii trained enthusiasm out of her,"
I said, rubbing vigorously at Shadow's neck. She dropped down to sniff all around me in a circle, and Jesse took the opportunity to step closer.
"Are you okay?"
he said, studying my face. "More or less." I reached up and draped my arms around him, leaning some of my body weight on him. I closed my eyes. All I wanted was to fall asleep like this. Or at least have another serious make-out session. When she was satisfied that I was in one piece, Shadow sat down and looked up at us, head cocked to one side as if to say, "Now what?"
"It's time to go wake Dashiell," I told her.
First, though, I looked at Jesse. What happened to the Luparii guy that Aldrich left behind?
He snorted. "There was no guy. Aldrich just said that to keep Shadow from coming after you."
God, he was a dick.
"How's Noah?"
Jesse's face lit up. "He's great, actually. Sashi showed up around 1.
"What? Really?"
"Yep."
He told me about Sashi arriving at the hospital from Vegas.
"She called while I was on my way back here with Shadow, and Noah is out of the woods. His ankle is broken and he's banged up, but the doctors are decreasing the sedatives. They think he might wake up as early as tonight." "Your friend Sashi is really good."
I felt my whole body unknot a little.
"We're going to have to figure out what to tell him."
"What did they want with you?"
Jesse asked, meaning the Luparii. A couple of kids chose that moment to practically gallop past us in their rush to get into the 7-Eleven. I made a face.
"Come on, let's talk in the truck." Shadow hopped onto the back of the pickup, looking positively gleeful about getting to ride with the wind in her fur. I warned her to stay down so she didn't draw attention, but we both knew I wasn't going to enforce it. When I climbed into the passenger seat, I saw that Jesse had grabbed my vest, boots, and knife belt from Sunken City.
Yes!
I said out loud. Jesse drove, and we started the hour ride back toward Pasadena. It was already 4:30, and the sun would set at 7:36. Before I got sucked into the Wild Hunt situation, I called Molly and left a new voicemail telling her to still go to the hospital and keep an eye on Noah and Jesse's parents, but with a different cover story. She would come up with something. Then I called Will and Kirsten and arranged to meet at Dashiell's house at 6. It was cutting it close, but we would need at least an hour to get up to Pasadena, and Jesse wanted to stop at his house for clothes and, more importantly, lots and lots of weapons. On the way, I filled him in on everything I'd learned from Aldrich. I debated not telling him about Aldrich's offer, but if the Luparii was after the baby, that was something Jesse needed to know. He was upset when he realized they'd pulled it out of his brain, but I told him we didn't have time for his guilt hysterics, and that got him to smile. Jesse lived in a tiny apartment in the Echo Lake district. It was the kind of place you usually stayed in for just a year or two while you were figuring things out, but he'd had his lease forever. He found a parking spot on a side street and turned the truck off, pausing to look at me.
"Do you want to come up?"
he asked. There was an intensity to his tone that I didn't understand right away. Because I am naturally very dense. Then I got it. We didn't really have time for me to come up, but there was also a decent chance that one or both of us would die tonight, or that I'd be taken by force and shipped to France. So I didn't overthink it. I just got out of the truck. Shadow came up to the apartment, too. She didn't really give us a choice in the matter. And made her customary search for danger before she'd let me cross the threshold. Then she pointedly went into the living room, climbed on Jesse's couch, and flopped over with her head in the direction of the front door. She made every effort to look asleep. I wanted to laugh, but I was too nervous. Wordlessly, Jesse took my hand and led me past the tiny kitchen and into the tiny bedroom. It was messy and unpretentious. Just a box spring and mattress covered by a light quilt with a design like Spanish tiles. I'd seen into this room plenty of times from the hallway, but I'd never actually stepped inside. We'd been too busy being afraid of each other for that. Jesse closed the bedroom door and turned to me, resting his forehead on mine.
"Scarlet," he said, his face troubled. "When I was in the twisted slumber,"
he seemed to choke on the words. I reached up and put my hands on either side of his face.
"What?" "I saw you dead. It was bad."
"Ah." I was immune to the Luparii magic, but if it was as good as everyone seemed to think, what Jesse had experienced would have felt so much worse than a dream. "I'm right here." I took his hands and put them on my waist so he could see. "I'm fine."
"I know. I just wanted to... It made me realize I
tilted my head up so I could kiss him. This time it was tentative and light, as though I was afraid to hurt him.
Maybe I was.
He was the one who broke the kiss, craning his head back to look at me without moving away.
"Did you mean what you said on the phone?"
he asked.
"Yes."
I lifted my chin so I could look into his eyes. "I'm in love with you." He grinned that 1,000-watt smile that always made my insides melt.
"Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm in love with you, too."
"I know." Then I took a tiny step back, and my hand fluttered to my stomach.
But we're going to need to work out some logistics.
I chewed on my lip.
I'm keeping the baby.
His grin widened.
Good. Does that bother you?
Scarlet. Slowly, he got down on his knees in front of me, lifting the hem of my shirt to uncover a few inches of my stomach. He kissed it, his warm lips making me shiver.
How many adventures have I followed you into?
He sat into my skin. A lot, I admitted, although I'd classify most of them as misadventures.
I wouldn't.
He looked up at me with searching eyes.
Why do you think this would be different?
I caught my breath, unable to speak, as he whispered,
I'd follow you anywhere.
That wasn't enough, of course, not for a baby, but it was enough for today. My fingers tangled in his hair. I wanted to kiss him, but he didn't get up. Instead, he kissed my stomach again and unbuttoned my jeans, pulling the zipper down with exquisite slowness. I knew I should tell him to hurry. We didn't have time.
But at the moment, I didn't care.
We were stealing this time together, whether anyone else liked it or not. I sat down on the bed, and Jesse pulled off my jeans. Still kneeling, he pulled his shirt over his head, and I immediately ran my fingers over the muscles on his chest, making him shiver. He closed the distance between us and kissed me on the lips, his momentum carrying me back onto the bed. His tongue slid into my mouth like it had been made specifically for this purpose, and there were suddenly so many things I wanted to do that I'd never been allowed, a bucket list that applied exclusively to Jesse's body. I wanted to run my tongue along his collarbone and trace my nails on his back. I wanted to bite the muscle in his shoulder and slide my hand into his pants until he cried out. So I did. I did all those things, mostly while I was still kissing him. And then he was lifting my shirt over my head and kissing the top of my breasts. And I really needed him to have more access. So I pulled the sports bra top over my head while he made appreciative noises, his fingers tracing the muscles along my sides. And then his mouth closed over my breast, and I was gone, gone, gone. Chapter 41. I was late to my own war council. Embarrassing. I sort of expected the ride from Jesse's apartment to Dashiell's house in Pasadena to be embarrassing, too, but it just wasn't. Whenever traffic allowed, Jesse would reach over and take my hand, and I caught him smiling randomly. I might have teased him about it, but I was doing the same thing. With Shadow in the truck bed, her tongue lolling out with great happiness, this was the most at peace I'd felt in I didn't know how long. At Dashiell's, everyone was waiting for us. Kirsten and Will looked exhausted and impatient, and even the usually quiet Hane seemed antsy. I had a terrible thought, and the first thing out of my mouth was, Ophelia? A tiny smile flickered across Kirsten's face. She's safe, she said shortly. Abby took her out of town a few hours ago.
I sent Cliff with them, Hane said.
Cliff was one of Hane's daytime guys, and he'd accompanied me on my ill-fated trip to Vegas. I'd only seen him a couple of times since, but I had to smile at the thought of the reserved ex-military bodyguard shepherding sharp-tongued Abby and a 2-year-old on a trip.
You're late, Kirsten said, looking annoyed.
Sorry, I said, not meaning it. Are Dashiell and Beatrice still downstairs?
I moved them into Dashiell's office. Hane said pointedly, when you were late.
I refused to take the bait.
Okay, then.
I expanded my radius to include most of the mansion, feeling the two vampires wake up a few rooms away.
They'll be here in a minute. Where's Owen?
Kirsten's face took on a certain stubborn look.
I sent him away, too.
What?
Dashiell stood in the open doorway, dressed in his daytime casual clothes.
jeans and a wrinkled white dress shirt. He looked aghast. The last he'd heard, Owen had just knocked on my door.
We could have used him.
For bait? Kirsten countered. I won't allow it. The poor kid has been through enough.
We need fighters, Dashiell argued. And he's certainly motivated, from what you've told me.
His magic is basically useless for the near future, and I will not have you dangling him in front of the Lupari. Kirsten crossed her arms. He's a witch, in my city, so he falls under my protection.
Dashiell grumbled a little, but he finally had to concede that Owen was Kirsten's responsibility, not his.
It took a while to bring Dashiell, and to some extent, the others, up to speed on the events of the day, from Owen's story to Noah's attack to Aldrich's attempt to kidnap me at Sunken City. I knew we were short on time, so I went through the story as quickly as I could. When I got to the part about Aldrich taking me instead of killing me, Dashiell frowned.
Why would he need a null so badly? He must believe Scarlet can stop the Wild Hunt,
Will said thoughtfully. It's not just that, I said, feeling suddenly nervous. Jesse squeezed my hand under the table, and I nodded at him and turned to face the others. It's because I'm pregnant. The whole room seemed to go still. You know that expression, you could hear a pin drop? I swear if I'd had any bobby pins in my hair at that moment, I would have yanked one out and tossed it on the table in front of me.
That's not possible, Kirsten said. At the same moment, Beatrice began, Scarlet, honey, I think you've made a mistake.
No mistake, I told her. Jameson is the father. Two nulls. I wasn't sure I'd ever seen Dashiell quite so shocked. He's usually stone-faced about everything, even in my radius, but his whole face had gone slack. I admit, there was a tiny part of me that was finding this awesome.
This is what your trip was about, he said in a slightly dazed voice.
Yes, I went to see Maven, the cardinal vampire in Colorado. I hoped she might know more about nulls because of her age, and I was right. She told me that the baby would grow up to be a powerful witch, powerful enough to boost something called ley lines, which will boost all of magic. Everyone glanced at Kirsten, who held out her empty hands.
Ley lines are where witch magic is strongest, she confirmed, but only one line even touches the L.A. area, and it's not very strong.
Both Dashiell and Will started asking follow-up questions, but I said, Look, guys, can we talk about what this might mean if we all live through the night? Bottom line, I put a hand on my stomach. This is my baby, not a bargaining chip, not a hostage, and definitely not a threat to any of you.
I'd like to make sure we're all very clear on that.
My voice was mild, but I stared at them until, one by one, they all nodded. Even Dashiell, although, of course, he was last, just to be a dick. Only then did my shoulders relax, and I realized how tense I had been.
Meanwhile, the Wild Hunt is coming. What do we do?
I've evacuated 9 of my pack members, Will began, leaving 13 who will fight.
There are a few dozen vampires whom I would trust to go into battle, Dashiell said.
They both glanced at Kirsten, who looked uncertain.
We don't have many witches with combat experience, she explained. Few of them are powerful enough, and those who are mostly fear that power. I've sent nearly 200 witches away with their families. Of the ones who are left, I could count on maybe 40. They're all on standby, but I'm not sure what to do with them.
That was nowhere near all the old world members in Los Angeles, and I wondered about the rest. Did we just not trust them, or were they an actual threat? I knew there were plenty of backstabbing vampires who would be happy to see Dashiell lose power. Still, that was nearly 100 people, all told, and the Lupari had between 19 and 21,
depending on whether or not Killian's and Sabine's sleeping bags had been among those I'd counted at Sunken City. "I sort of have a plan," I told them.
"How much of a plan?"
Jesse asked beside me. I flashed him a grin and said under my breath, 12%. To the others, I said, "But we need to know where they're going to be. I need help with that."
"Do you have a map of the city?"
Will asked Dashiell. Beatrice got up and retrieved a map of the greater L.A. area. Trust vampires to still have paper maps. Will took it and handed it to Kirsten.
"Where is this ley line?"
She shot him an appreciative look and pulled a pen out of her purse. She drew a curving line from the Simi Valley southeast through Canoga Park and Burbank, curving around and south all the way to Long Beach, not too far from Sunken City. Even from the other side of the table, the line looked familiar, and I got up and went over for a closer look. "It follows the river," I declared, pointing at the blue line whose course was almost identical to the pen line. "I saw it on a map this afternoon at the river center."
"I'd never paid much attention, but I suppose that makes sense," Kirsten said thoughtfully. "Ley lines often follow natural landmarks, and that river's been there in some form or another since the Tongva."
The Tongva were the Native American people who had occupied the L.A. Basin before the first Spanish settlers.
"Staying near the ley line would likely boost the hunt's strength."
"It's not just that."
Jesse leaned forward to trace his finger along the line.
"They can use the riverbed itself to get around the city."
He was right.
"That's good to know and all, but they'll be somewhere along the river isn't enough for us to go on,"
Will pointed out. "No, it isn't," I agreed. "Unless we could predict exactly where they're going to turn up and be waiting for them." Every head in the room turned to look at me. "How fast can you guys assemble your people?" I asked. Chapter 42. I started laying out my plan, or my 12% of a plan, and the others spent 15 minutes poking holes in it. The biggest question was whether or not I would be able to stop the Wild Hunt magic. We would have to bet everything, everyone, on the theory that I could.
"How sure are you?"
Kirsten asked, looking worried. I chewed on my lip for a moment. "Mostly sure?" The other three old world leaders exchanged looks.
"That's not overwhelming me with confidence," Dashiell said.
"Okay, let me show you something. Please, just humor me for a second. Bea and Dashiell, can you come stand by me?" They raised their eyebrows, but pushed their chairs back and came toward me. I looked at the wall, where Shadow was curled up next to the door so she could ambush intruders. "Shadow? Can you come here?" The Bargist stood and trotted over to me. I asked her to sit next to my chair, and then I stood up and went to the other side of the room, positioning her between myself and the others. I brought Beatrice and Dashiell with me so they wouldn't turn into dead vampires again.
"Be very still," I advised Will and Kirsten. "Will, fight your instincts."
Before anyone could react, I pulled in my radius. Almost immediately, Shadow stood up and ran straight for Will, her teeth bared. He followed my advice and held still while she stood 3 feet away from him, the hair on the back of her neck bristling straight up. Her whole body was tensed, waiting for the command to rip out his throat. Carefully, I extended my radius until it encompassed Shadow, but not Will. The Bargist calmed down. She did a little dance in place, whined, and then retreated to stand next to me.
"But I'm still a werewolf," Will said, confused.
I released my radius back to its usual area, and we all went back to our seats. Jesse, who had watched the whole demonstration with disinterested calm, grinned at me. "The Bargist magic is Wild Hunt magic, and it works on two levels," I explained. "There are the permanent physical effects, which give her strength and speed and the impenetrable skin,
but there's also the non-physical component of the magic that lets her heal quickly and forces her to want to hunt and kill werewolves. I gestured to Will. The physical stuff is permanent. I can't undo it. But the non-physical stuff is affected by me. I shrugged. Spectral warriors, to me, implies non-physical. Definitely not permanent. So, I'm mostly sure I can stop the wild hunt. They all looked at me thoughtfully.
What about the animals? Kirsten asked. In all the lore, there are horses and dogs, at the very least.
That's what I'm not sure about. I checked my watch. We had 20 minutes until sunset, though I doubted that the wild hunt would begin the moment the sun went down. That kind of complex magic would require a whole ritual to begin.
That's why we need fighters.
And another thing, Jesse added, looking inspired.
I don't suppose any of you have access to animal tranquilizers?
A couple of minutes later, the conference room sort of became the situation room, as everyone began talking or texting, trying to assemble their people. I expanded my radius so Beatrice and Dashiell could move around the mansion, and kept an eye on Will as he made his calls. Many of his weaker werewolves had already left town, so he didn't have as many calls to make as the others. When he finished, I asked him if we could talk in the hall for a minute. He looked surprised. The two of us didn't really do much one-on-one time, especially since I had broken up with his second-in-command. But he complied.
What's up?
He asked, after I closed the door behind us.
Listen, I began, not really sure how to begin this conversation.
You know we're probably all gonna die tonight, right?
He shrugged.
Yeah, but we've been probably going to die before.
That's not grammatically sound, but yeah. Anyway, I took a deep breath. It was stupid of me to interfere, of course, but hey, sometimes I do stupid things. Will had a daughter he didn't know about. Sashi had never told him about Grace, and now it might be too late. When I'd called her on the way to Dashiell's place to thank her for saving Noah, I'd asked if I could tell Will she was in town.
"Do you think that's really necessary?"
she'd said in a panicky voice.
"I'm going back tonight. He doesn't need to know I was ever here."
"Sashi," I'd tried to think of the right words, and finally just said, "I'm pregnant." She'd gasped.
"That's not possible."
"Apparently it is.
Do you remember the guy I lost in Vegas? The other Noel?" Despite what was happening with Jesse, it still hurt to think of Jameson. It probably always would.
"Yeah?"
Sashi said, and then,
"Oh."
"Yeah. He died not knowing he was going to have a kid. And Will, there's a good chance we won't make it through this tonight."
"I see," she'd said in a small voice.
"Look, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be the world's shittiest mom, and I have no right to give you advice. But maybe if Grace met Will, maybe if she understood why you couldn't marry John..." There was a long silence, and I was sure I'd overstepped. But all Sashi had said was,
"What do you have in mind?"
Now that I was standing across from the alpha werewolf, I struggled for the right words. "This morning, when Noah was attacked," I said finally, "I made a call to a healing witch I met in Las Vegas. She took a late morning plane and got here in time to save him."
"A healing witch?"
he echoed.
There really wasn't any way to sugarcoat this.
"Well, it's Sashi." His face changed. Actually, his everything changed. His body language went from loose and relaxed to sort of defensive and prepared, like he thought I was about to kick him in the teeth, and there was nothing he could do to stop me.
"Hi, Sashi," he said, in a voice that sliced my heart.
I nodded. "She's in town.
although she's on a late flight back to Vegas in a few hours, if, you know, you wanted to talk to her. He stared at me.
Why did you? I mean, how did you and her?
He drifted off and then sort of shook himself.
Does she want to talk to me?
Not really, but Sashi felt that the news should come from her, which I had to respect. She thinks it might be a good idea, I said carefully, but it's up to you.
How do I? Should I call her?
The alpha werewolf of Los Angeles suddenly looked like an uncertain kid on his way to pick up his prom date. I checked my watch again. She should be parked out on the road. He turned and started toward the door before pausing.
Thanks, Scarlett,
he said quietly. I felt like I should add something.
Wait until you learn what I've been keeping from you.
But I just nodded and headed back into the conference room, shutting the door behind me. Dashiell called me over. He was standing with Beatrice and Hane, who looked a little guilty.
Did you invite a boundary witch into my territory? Dashiell said, his face clouded over with annoyance.
Oops.
With everything that had happened, I'd completely forgotten that Katja was coming to help Wyatt. But she would have called Hane when she arrived, and Hane would have felt obligated to tell Dashiell. I couldn't really blame him for that. A little bit? Dashiell frowned, and I rushed to add, Look, it didn't seem like a big enough thing to wake you up over during the day. But, yeah, I thought if Katja had any chance of saving Wyatt, it was worth a phone call.
And, okay, I'd forgotten about it.
Beatrice laid a hand on his arm, and he sighed.
Sometimes, he said tiredly, I honestly think you're trying to drive me insane.
It's really more of a fringe benefit than an overall goal, I said helpfully.
Beatrice shot me a look. I'm sorry, I added, more contrite.
It's been an intense week.
Dashiell just waved me away. Chapter 43. When most people think of rivers, they think, you know, large body of quickly moving water. But the Los Angeles River is different. Mostly, it's a gigantic concrete trough that usually has a trickle of filthy liquid running down the middle. You know the big race at the end of Greece, where they're in the wide concrete channel that's completely dry except for a tiny bit of water? Yeah, that's the LA River. It's littered and polluted, and until very recently, it was one of many ugly things in Los Angeles that people just sort of averted their eyes from, like homeless people, graffiti, and the condition of all public bathrooms. In the last decade or so, however, activists had made serious efforts to rebrand and revitalize the river, starting with removing the concrete bottom from many sections so native plants could grow in again. New parks had also sprung up along the river, and bike trails, and there were places where you could even kayak. The vast majority of it, however, was still a wide, dry channel. And if you weren't concerned with being seen, or facing possibly violent homeless squatters, you could use it to move through most of the city. There was no traffic, no crowds of distracting humans, and, best of all, no one paying attention. Kirsten had called in the witch who did volunteer work for the LA River, and she'd arrived at Dashiell's house within 15 minutes, which was pretty damned impressive. Her name turned out to be Paloma Green, which really, really sounded made up, but then again, that could just be LA for you. I was expecting some variation on New Age hippie, but Paloma arrived in jeans and a button-down shirt, smelling of fertilizer. She was about 50, with short, sensible black hair and the look of someone accustomed to running four lives at once. A mom look.
I was working in the garden, she said, unconsciously scrubbing her hands together, though they didn't look dirty. What do you need?
Kirsten explained, and Paloma went over to the map, still spread across the conference room table.
She stood there for a few minutes, with her hands on her hips, looking over her options. Part of the recent revitalization project had included setting up a bunch of new parks along the river, or sprucing up existing parks to encourage people who wanted to use the channel for bike or walking trails. Paloma pointed at a green spot very close to Long Beach. I squinted to read the name. Maywood Riverfront Park.
This one, she said. There are residential homes around the park, but most of it is fenced and contained, and the entrance from the river forms a choke point.
Thank you, Paloma, Kirsten said. Will you join us? We could use your expertise. Paloma bowed her head.
I'm not sure how useful I'll be, she said, but I will do my best.
After that, it was a matter of getting everyone the park's address and telling them to head down there immediately with whatever weapons they could carry, except for two of Dashiell's vampires who were out trying to press a noted veterinarian who worked with the L.A. Zoo to get some serious tranquilizer. The idea was simple. If the witches of the Wild Hunt could only see the supernatural, we could draw them to wherever we wanted by gathering all of L.A.'s remaining supernaturals in one place, instead of riding through the city lopping the heads off witches and werewolves who might be trying to hide or run. They would be drawn to the hunting ground we'd chosen. It sounded easy in theory, but Kirsten and Dashiell, especially, had a hard time persuading their people to come be, well, bait wasn't quite the right word, but it was probably the closest one. We needed to reach critical mass, and only by threatening and cajoling were the leaders able to convince everyone to join in. Dashiell could have ordered his vampires to come, since they'd all sworn loyalty to him to be allowed to live in his city, but he couldn't do it over the phone, and he said that soldiers who were being forced to fight were not the kind of soldiers anyone wanted. Happily, convincing other people to join us had been Will, Kirsten, and Dashiell's problem, not mine. In the end, I think the tipping point was that those who refused would be taking their own kind of risk. After all, a werewolf on his own would still be vulnerable to the Wild Hunt. I went down to the park with the first wave of people, including Jesse and Shadow, of course, because I needed to get inside the territory so Kirsten could set the humans go away spell. She had offered to give Jesse a witch bag, which would have protected him from the spell, but he'd shaken his head firmly.
Then I couldn't go near Scarlet, he'd pointed out, taking my hand. Where she goes, I go.
Kirsten had looked from him to our joined hands, to my face, which was turning red. She'd given us a wide, sunny smile.
About damned time, she'd said.
Dashiell must have called his contacts at the LAPD or the highway patrol, because Jesse raced the truck down the freeway doing nearly 90, and we weren't the only ones. As soon as we arrived, I could see why Paloma had chosen this particular park. It was sort of wedge-shaped, with one edge formed by busy Slauson Avenue and the other by the river. The park itself formed the curved part of the wedge, enclosed, mostly, by an iron fence. That made me hopeful. Many of the legends suggested that the Wild Hunt riders weren't able to pass through iron.
It was worth a shot, at least.
Speaking of which, Jesse had two guns in hip holsters, and he'd convinced me to take his Glock, which I'd put into a small of the back holster. Under that, I had my knife belt, and under that, a bulletproof vest. I felt bulky as hell, and I couldn't see how the Luparii would be able to carry guns anyway. Spectral guns. But I wanted to be prepared. And as much as I disliked the things, I wasn't at all opposed to bringing guns to a sword fight. Shadow was trotting along on my other side, and I sort of wanted the three of us to start walking in slow motion. We were so obviously ready for a fight. We jog-walked to the center of the park, surveying the territory.
How do you want to do this?
Jesse asked me. Humans go away spell starting on the other side of that bridge, I said, pointing, and closing off this section of Slauson Avenue.
That includes the bridge.
He grimaced.
It's gonna piss people off.
I sent him a sweet smile. What's the point of having city officials in your pocket if you're not gonna take them out and mess with them once in a while?
What about the riverbed itself? He said. Are we closing off a section?
I shook my head. They might be able to feel the spell, or they might bring humans along for the specific purpose of feeling out traps. Let's close the bike path, but leave the riverbed open. That gave me another idea. We should actually get a couple of human servants to hang out in the riverbed, a quarter mile in either direction, like spotters. I could ask Dashiell to get some of the human servants on it.
I thought humans couldn't see the Wild Hunt,
Jesse commented. Not the hunters, but if the Wild Hunt includes Bargists, they should be able to see them.
I didn't know about the horses.
I turned around.
The residential area is going to be a bigger problem.
There weren't a ton of houses facing the park, but there were some. Kirsten can set another human's go away, but when the vampires start arriving, we should still have them go door to door.
Agreed.
With that, there was not much else I could do except stay away from the edges of where Kirsten was planning to set spells. Jesse hurried off to talk to the people who were arriving, and I sat down on a bench in the middle of the park. Shadow jumped on the bench beside me, causing it to quake, but when it didn't collapse, she lay down, allowing me to lean on her like a pillow. Within the next half hour, Kirsten and the big group of chanting witches following her around had almost finished setting spells on the edges of our target area, and the vampires were clearing the neighboring homes. Everyone in this part of Long Beach was going to have a sudden desire to go to the movies, or a bar, or whatever the vampires felt like telling them. Meanwhile, the wolves, except for Will, were in wolf form, prowling around the edges of the territory. They were bouncing around a little, and I figured they must be excited about this additional chance to change into their wolf forms when it wasn't the full moon. They steered clear of me, and vice versa. Mostly this was so I didn't turn them human again, but I also didn't want to tempt Shadow by dangling werewolves in front of her nose. Okay, fine. My ex-boyfriend Eli had turned furry so he could lead them, and I was pathetically grateful to stay away from him. Jesse came over and plopped down on the bench next to me.
Kirsten needs me near you now, he said. She's going to make sure there aren't any humans still in the area.
I nodded, lifted my head off Shadow, and turned to face him. I wish we had some of that ointment Reese mentioned, I said. It would be really helpful if you could see the hunt, too.
He shrugged. There just wasn't enough time.
He had draped one arm along the back of the bench, and now he lifted his hand to smooth back my hair.
How you doing?
I'm okay. Tired, but okay. A beat. And then he said,
How are you doing about earlier?
I squirmed, still surveying all the activity in the park. On that matter, I would say I am doing exceptional.
No regrets,
he said, and I stopped watching the witch crowd and turned to find him studying me. No regrets, I said softly. He gave me a quick, chaste kiss, and then it was back to waiting. Everything took a lot longer than I'd anticipated, but then there was no sign of the Luparii yet. I only hoped their prep was taking as long as ours. I felt the vampire hit my radius, and Dashiell nodded to us as he and Beatrice sat on a nearby bench. A few minutes later, Kirsten and Hane sat down, hands clutched together. Will appeared out of the shadows and loomed against a nearby tree. His eyes were red. You okay? I asked. He had been late to arrive because he'd been talking to Sashi. He just gave me a look. In a low voice, he said,
You should have told me.
There was no reason for that to sting, but it did. It wasn't mine to tell. Will just shook his head and stared into the darkness, like he was too angry to even look at me. I decided to shut up.
We sat there like that for a few more minutes, just waiting. It occurred to me that this had never happened before, the seven of us together in one place at the same time. Usually it was smarter to divide your resources, and Dashiell himself rarely joined in a fight. Actually, now that I thought about it, I wasn't sure this group had ever faced a straightforward fight before. I sat up straight and looked around. The park was full of small groups of people talking in hushed tones. I knew if I expanded my radius, I would encounter witches, vampires, and werewolves of all ages and strengths. This was our community, brought together to face a common enemy. It was kind of nice, if you didn't think about the part where we might all die. Around midnight, Dashiell flinched suddenly, lifting a hand that was already holding a cell phone. He read the text and looked up, right at me.
"The spotter to the north," he said, standing up.
"They're here."
Chapter 44.
I pulled in my radius, and Jesse and I ran to the corner of the wedge, through the gate leading down to the riverbed. Most of the old world could see just fine in the dim light from the city, at least for now, but Dashiell's vampires had set out powerful camping lanterns along each bank, spaced every 100 feet or so. From the air, we probably looked like a bizarre runway. I'd never really looked at the riverbed at night, but the dry concrete bed seemed even bigger somehow, and alien, like the concave surface of the moon. It really was an enormous amount of space. I turned right, crossing the narrow bike path and climbing down into the riverbed with Jesse and Shadow alongside me. The other leaders followed behind us, out of my radius,